Welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast series by Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic think tank. I'm Giuseppe Porcaro, and today we will speak about decentralized finance and explore whether digitalized decentralized services will become established and normalized. Joining me for this discussion are Maria De Mertzis, senior fellow at Bruegel. Hi, Maria.
Hi, Giuseppe. Lovely to be here.
And Katarina Martins, who is a research analyst also here at Bruegel. Hi, Katarina.
Hi, thanks for having me.
I'm very happy because it's Katarina's first podcast today. So it's really nice to have you over there. And both Katarina and Maria have been writing a paper on the topic, which is downloadable on our website. And the link is in the show notes. So going into the topics, cryptocurrencies have become more popular and established. And alongside this, crypto financial services like lending have also emerged. Given the increasing importance of digitalization, it is fair to ask whether these digital decentralized services will become established and normalized. Answering that question requires a little bit of digging on whether and how the crypto world contributes to the main objectives of the financial system, which is to reduce search costs and to contribute to financing growth. You have both co-authored this paper, which I just mentioned before, and we would like to explore these things with you. And first things first, though, can you, perhaps Maria, explain me what are crypto financial services and place this into the context?
Yeah, thanks very much for doing this. As you said, Katarina and I have done this paper. Actually, we started working on this paper some time ago now. It's kind of interesting that we started maybe about a year ago or thereabouts. It's been that long, right? And what's interesting about this is actually changing format as we were researching, because things happen in the crypto world and you know, the shape of the paper actually changed since we first started. But to come to your question of what is this crypto world, this crypto financial services, it really is what the name suggests, which is providing financial services, but not based on what we'd normally call sovereign currencies, the euro, the dollar, the pound, but on cryptocurrencies. And there are a number of them. The most famous one, and actually the most dominant one in economic value, is Bitcoin. So it's as though I issue a loan or I take a loan, but based on Bitcoins. In other words, I receive Bitcoins and I pay back Bitcoins or any other currency. That, of course, generates a rather different financial service, because the currency is a private currency. It's not a sovereign currency, which has got a number of characteristics. And in the paper, we explore very much how different these financial services are. And importantly, and again, as you said in your introductory remark, Giuseppe, what is it that they do differently and what is it that they add to the financial system, good or bad, and how do we protect ourselves, or how do we encourage the good bits of it? This is what the paper does.
Thank you. Katarina, do you want to add something about that?
Maybe just to complement here on this whole context in which these financial services are placed. You know, this all kind of started with this new technology that was called the distributed ledger technology. Actually, most of us have heard about blockchain, which is actually a form of distributed ledger technology, in which basically these transactions are recorded and organized in digital blocks that then are linked together, hence the name blockchain. And what is interesting here is that this innovation doesn't necessarily require this intermediary. So there are various validators out there, and the first one validating this transaction then records this in this system. And it's precisely based on this type of technology that then Bitcoin emerged and the all other cryptocurrencies. And then later on, because of the volatility of these cryptocurrencies, then stablecoins emerged. And after that, then came decentralized financial services. And so this is just to contextualize a bit, you know, the whole process of evolution in this space and the environment in which these decentralized services then developed.
One of the main features, which I understand stems from both this world, crypto world, is the elimination of intermediaries. It comes with this like kind of promise of not only efficiency gains, but also other things that goes around it, about cutting the middleman, right? Many people think that this is the big strength of these systems and is what eventually would completely revolutionize monetary and financial markets. Do you think we can realistically head towards such a promised land of no middleman, like completely automatized blockchain-based kind of secure transactions? Or let me reformulate, is a financial world without intermediaries really a greener pasture or not?
I think that's a very important point, to just start there and sort of understand what did this sort of crypto revolution promise and how well has it delivered on this promise, right? And I think that's very important. I mean, when it first started, when I first understood what blockchain was, which is, as Katarina said, a DLT, decentralized ledger technology, I thought it was revolutionary because it was exactly about cutting the middleman. So let me just explain what that is. So if I want to transfer money from one account to my mother's account, somebody has to verify that I have the money. It takes it away from my account and put it into my mother's account, right? And now my mother is the legitimate claimer of this money, right? Somebody does this process where now I lose the money I transfer. I no longer have a claim on it and somebody else does, namely my mother, right? That is a legal transaction, right? I mean, it has legal validity. I lose the money I transfer in the sense I no longer have a claim on it and my mother does. This is absolutely essential because the whole system rests on this validation where I transfer the money, so I renege on my ability to have a claim on this and somebody else does, right? Now, that's the middleman, right? And when the blockchain revolution, if I may call it so, happened, there was no need for this middleman. The blockchain itself, the technology, had what they called many verifiers. There had to be 50% plus one more verifiers. And all of these people would verify that Maria no longer has a claim on these euros and her mother does. Yeah. And there was incentives for doing that. And this is the wonderful blockchain process. Now, it turns out that it takes a lot of time to do this verification process, whereas the banks, particularly now in the euro system, but also in the US, they do this almost instantaneously, this verification process. And by the way, it costs a lot of electricity, so it's not very environmentally friendly. So to your question, it was very much a revolutionary promise. It hasn't delivered very well. And actually, what we discover now is that we're going back into introducing what they call centralized as opposed to decentralized ledgers, which is effectively introducing some form of a middleman. So we've gone full circle where we understood that actually there is value in having a middleman. And actually, the financial literature on all of this actually gives the middleman a very important role. Not only on providing the legal claim, the legal validity of it, but also on eliminating some of the transactions that the transaction costs that this technology promised to eliminate.
Provided all this caveat and contextualization, what exactly do we mean by decentralized finance?
First of all, maybe it's important to explain that mostly decentralized finance builds on this Ethereum network, which was launched in 2015. And what was so revolutionary about this new network was the fact that, you know, there would be the possibility to build these decentralized applications that made it possible, you know, the ideal space for decentralized finance to develop. So DeFi stands for decentralized finance, really represents a kind of an expansion of this initial concept of, you know, Bitcoin, making some transactions to really this more complex system in which financial services are also provided. And two important characteristics of decentralized finance are the fact that it's decentralized and non-custodial. And decentralized means mostly that it's peer-to-peer. So the fact that there's no intermediary, like we were talking before. And also the non-custodial really means that each one of us has full control of the private key that unlocks these assets. So basically this code that we have, that we only us have. And so to this extent, we have full control over it. Also, something quite particular is that the only criteria to participate in decentralized financial services is that you own crypto assets. So what we hear in traditional finance, for instance, and why some people are currently excluded from the financial system is, for example, when they ask for a loan, they might not have a good credit score, so they cannot get this loan. Supposedly, in decentralized finance, this is not a problem. Of course, for this to happen, there has to be, you know, some kind of backup, some guarantee. And in the case of decentralized finance, this is in the form of very high collateralization. So you actually have to pledge big amounts of the crypto assets you own in order to actually get a loan. And just a last thing I would like to add is that smart contracts here are central to the way decentralized finance works. And basically, very simply, what these smart contracts are is these computer programs that automatically execute an agreement between two parties when certain conditions are met. So this really, again, goes back to the elimination of the intermediary, because everything is written in coding in these contracts. And so when conditions are met, they execute. And basically, these decentralized applications that I talked before, which are what creates these different financial services in this environment, are, allows for all this to work, these financial services to be provided without these middlemen and everything.
Yeah, no, I just wanted to pick on a couple of things you say, because I think that's absolutely essential. First, go back a little bit one step. I mean, remember that cryptocurrencies, which is what we're talking about here, they're all private money. They're issued privately. There isn't the government here that issues the money, or a state, or they call sovereign money, right? So the Bitcoin, which was the first one, and actually remains the most important one, if you look at sort of the economic value of all the cryptos that are out there, the Bitcoin is by far the most dominant one. So Bitcoin was issued by somebody. I don't even know that we know still who the issuer of Bitcoin is. But in any case, it exists. It has got an algorithm that is obvious, is very transparent. And you can buy and sell Bitcoins if you participate in that market. That is an important thing, because go back to the sort of the value of money and so forth, the trust that we have in money. Now there is a private issued money, and you know there is demand for it. Therefore, there is kind of an interactions, there's transactions happening with this money. I think that's very important. If I have Bitcoin and you have Bitcoin and we agree that I will give you a loan, that's what we call DeFi, decentralized finance. It's I'm issuing a financial service, a loan, but I'm doing it with crypto. And as Katerina said, the only criteria for participating in that market is that you have the currency in question. Whereas in the traditional financial systems, or the banking system, it's not obvious that you have access to all the financial services, namely loans, because you need to have certain characteristics, possession of collateral, or you need to have the right credit score, as Katerina said. So it's not always the case that you have access to financial services. Whereas with decentralized finance, if you have Bitcoin and you can go and buy Bitcoin, you will have access to these decentralized financial services. And that, of course, is an interesting issue, because that gives access to financial services for people that previously maybe, and it's important that I raise this issue, maybe did not have access to financial services.
Picking up on what you just said, on a global scale, so decentralized finance, to some extent, what you're saying is that it has the potential to reach populations that are currently excluded
indeed
from the financial system. Let's say that if you have an internet connection, a crypto wallet, an individual can trade, receive a loan, send a cross-border payment, earn interests or an asset or execute other financial transactions that otherwise would have required a traditional intermediary, right?
Exactly, absolutely.
So is this a solution for financial inclusion?
I don't know what Katerina thinks about this. My sense is that it's a big illusion, this thing, because you actually see that in practice. First of all, let's say that the crypto world, in terms of how big it is very small, less than 1% of global financial assets. So this big promise that we were going to have a takeover of the crypto world simply didn't happen. And then those who use it are not necessarily the financially excluded individuals in the world. I mean, you do need an internet connection, but you also need to be digitally savvy to participate in these currencies. And I would argue you also need to be financially savvy to understand what this really means, what kind of risks you take. And in fact, if you like, some of the bad things about this world is that people who participate are digitally savvy, but are not necessarily financially savvy. And that creates for a lot of financial risks. A lot of wealth is being destroyed as a result of just knowing the techniques, but not knowing what lies behind them. So I don't think this is the answer to financial exclusion, but maybe Katerina has a more nuanced view.
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree with what you said. I would just like to point out two more things. So in addition to the digital and financial literacy that is required, actually, you know, it's still an ecosystem that is still very prone to scams and fraud and theft. So this can be also an issue. And again, going back to what Maria mentioned about destroying wealth, because if you have US dollars, you convert it into bitcoins, you're here playing this system, you lose this money. This money will not go back to the traditional financial system. This money kind of is destroyed, disappears. And my second point is that, you know, actually decentralized finance can become relatively expensive at some point. So there are very high fees sometimes. And this can actually, even for people that are financially excluded wanting to participate in this system, then when they go and see how expensive it can be to transact sometimes, it can exclude these people.
Let me provoke you a little bit and push you, because still we've been saying that there is a potential over there. There are some risks, but there is also potential to reach out population which was not usually touched by financial services. So is your point of view nuanced? Like, is there something that we can use, especially for financial literacy purpose, or if complemented with the specific support programs, is there still a potential to use this new technology for reaching out to those populations which are not included in the financial system? Or are you suggesting that basically just make a warning that there are just risks and not some uptake, you know, over there?
Yeah. Let me just differentiate first between the technology and the actual asset. Bitcoin is the asset, but there's also technology behind that. I think the technology itself is revolutionary. And my prediction, and you know, I'm willing to sort of to make the prediction, is that this technology will seep through to the traditional system. So the ledger and how we can actually decentralize it or centralize it in ways that is efficient. I think there is great scope there for penetrating the traditional financial system. Now, when it comes to the assets themselves, I would argue that there is place for these assets to exist. And you see that there is demand for them. I mean, very much like we demand other things. So I think that these things actually will exist because there is some sort of an issue there about the value that they give us. The reason why I think they exist is the one feature that they have is that they are trans-borders. I mean, so they're available globally. So anybody, anywhere can access those assets in the way that you cannot access the dollar or the euro anywhere. They're not available. And I want to give an example, which I was recently made aware of, which I thought was very interesting. Somebody trading from Europe to an African country is pricing the product that they're trading in euros, but the country in Africa that is supposed to pay for this does not have euros to pay. So they pay bitcoins, and actually they facilitate this transaction in bitcoins. And what they do is that they take very little exchange rate risk by transforming the currencies almost instantly from one to the other. So that, because we know the Bitcoin is a very unstable currency, and you have to sort of do it almost instantaneously to avoid exchange rate risk. So there is an enabler, if you like. The digital availability of this currency is an enabler of trade that previously maybe wouldn't have happened. And therefore, I think just like any other asset, there is demand for it, and I think it will survive. What's important is to understand what kind of risks it brings into. So the people that participate in this market understand, just like with any other risky asset, that they're taking risks. And, you know, when you're taking risks, wealth is made, but wealth is also destroyed. It's important to understand that, you know, there is actually that possibility.
Going back to the point that Maria was making, I think it's important to differentiate here also what is like transactions using cryptocurrencies or even stable coins and what is decentralized financial services, because there's a difference here. And of course, you know, having access to this market, even if we think about, you know, less advanced countries that rely heavily on remittances, this can be very important to facilitate this process. But then participating in decentralized financial services, for example, DEXs, which is decentralized exchanges, very closely resembling stock exchanges as we have it now, of course, requires, or I mean, it's already something more complex that requires, even for traditional stock market, you know, financial literacy. So I think it's important to differentiate here and to understand where it could address financial inclusion to a certain extent and where there's more need in terms of education and training for people to participate in more complex financial services in the crypto space.
That's very clear. But What I'm wondering, because there is quite a balancing act between the risks and the opportunities over there. You mentioned before that the crypto ecosystem represents only a very, very small fraction of the entire financial system. Does it mean that even if there are risks within the crypto ecosystem, does it mean that it does not represent a systemic risk to the overall financial stability since it's so small?
It's interesting you say that because when the big global financial crisis started, it started with a very small segment of the housing market in the US, what they call the subprime market, you may remember this. And that was much smaller than 1% of the global financial system. And yet it created all these very nonlinear effects, the butterfly effects that became the global financial crisis. So I think the regulators are very right to worry about the effects that something going wrong in this particular segment of the market, the decentralized finance market, can actually translate into a bigger thing. So they are paying attention. And in fact, as we know, regulation is slowly catching up to try and incorporate the decentralized financial services into traditional regulation. And in fact, all the 2022 was a bad year for decentralized finance. A number of things went wrong. And, you know, it revealed all the reasons why we have regulation in the traditional financial system. There are no shortcuts here. When you're entering a market and you want to borrow something, you need to have collateral. You need to have value behind you that is allowing you to leverage up, is allowing you to borrow. This is absolutely essential. I think that decentralized finance, which is still an emerging segment of the market, is still very much a promise that I'm going to lend you without collateral. Instances of that we've seen in 2023. The possibility of losing trust in that market is very, very big. And this is exactly also what happened with a number of things in 2022. Collateral is essential. No shortcuts there.
Yeah, and also if I may add, you know, right now this is the size of the crypto assets in total financial assets. But, you know, as this develops and also it expands, its weight in financial transactions overall might increase. And also it may become more interconnected with the current players in the traditional financial system. And of course, this also calls for, you know, regulators to take this into consideration when they're making financial stability assessments. So it's increasingly important to take into consideration this market. Of course, it's still not mainstream. It's still relatively small, but, you know, the potential effects that it can have, like butterfly effects. And even if we think about the market sentiment, you know, if market movements start becoming very interconnected, what can happen is that if there are big increases in crypto markets, or it can have an effect on, you know, market moves also in traditional finance. But if the other thing happens, so if there's a big devaluation in crypto markets, this can also affect traditional financial markets. And of course, this goes back to the question of destruction of wealth. And it can, of course, offer here a potential big risk in terms of financial stability. So it can have an impact, I would say.
Maybe before we go towards the end of this episode, there is another question I wanted to ask, because all these transactions happen in the virtual world. So one may think that they do not have any kind of physical manifestation, but they do consume energy. And there are physical limits that we should consider. It's not just the size of the current size of this market within the financial system, but also the actual potential for growth when it comes to the physical world, especially when it comes to energy consumption and the impact on carbon emissions and sustainability and so on. So can an exponential growth of the crypto ecosystem and this decentralized finance be sustained and sustainable?
I would say that in the future, yes, that could be a possibility, but there are still quite some challenges to be overcome for that to become a reality, let's say. Well, first and foremost, in terms of, you know, scalability, transactions are still quite slow in terms of processing time, which also leads to very high transaction fees. And, you know, just for a comparison to give here some numbers, Ethereum network, which is where decentralized finance is developed on, can currently handle more or less around 30 transactions per second, while Visa, which we all know very well, I think, has a capacity to handle up to 65,000 transactions per second. And here we really see the work that still needs to be done to improve these networks and to make it really scalable so that it could be used, you know, as we use right now Visa, we go everywhere, buy something, we use it. There are many transactions that are being processed per second, but the infrastructure really needs to be there in order for this to be scalable at a very large scale, potentially globally. And also, you know, what this means, it's like all these bottlenecks end up creating very high transaction fees. And, you know, even like I was mentioning before, this means that DeFi services can just become too expensive for people to participate in them. And of course, the Ethereum network is aware of this. They are trying to find here solutions in order to improve not only the time it takes to process transactions and these transaction fees, but also to reduce the energy intensity of the validation process. So recording these transactions in the ledgers. And roughly speaking, I will use here some terms, but I will explain them. They are trying to do this switch from proof of work to proof of stake. So basically what this means is that instead of validators being spread around the world and kind of fighting or running to be the first ones to solve this problem so that they are the ones receiving the compensation for the validation, what happens is that only some selected validators are looking to these transactions and validating them. This means, one, if there are less people validating across the world, less energy is needed for the process, which is good. And also this may, you know, then there are other types of improvements in the processes, protocols, everything that can increase the speed of the processing of the transactions. But yeah, so roughly speaking, I would say that there's still a lot of work to do.
Still a long way to go.
Yeah, and it might take quite several years to actually reach a point in which they are ready to take something like what Visa does currently.
By going from many validators to very few validators in this change of regime implies that actually we are losing the decentralized nature of this whole process, which actually beats the purpose of the original innovation. And that of course is necessary in order to solve the energy problem and time processing.
So Maria, final question and maybe a rhetorical question at this stage. Will decentralized finance take over in the end?
For the moment, decentralized finance is really what I would call very self-referential, meaning that it's just a group of people, an ecosystem that interacts with themselves. I borrow Bitcoin and pay with Bitcoin, but it never leaves the system and becomes real value added, which is very important. It's the first thing you started with, Giuseppe, when you said, you know, what is the role of the financial system is to promote the creation of value, to promote growth. A system that is self-referential doesn't feed into this process and therefore doesn't solve the purpose of finance in the way that ideally it should. So in order for decentralized finance to become a sort of a valid component of finance, it needs to come out of its closet, as it were, and become a process that helps finance growth. Till then, I think it will just be a very geeky part of the system that some people use, but it will not be mainstream.
Thank you. And I would say that we could discuss for much longer, but this is all the time we have for this episode. And I would like to remind our listeners that the paper of Maria and Katarina is downloadable in open source on our website, www.bruegel.org, and the precise link is in the show notes. And I would like to thank both of you once again for this conversation. And I would like to thank also our listeners for following us. So until next time, bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye. Thank you for having us.